I'd like to think and speak of men, mountains, and molehills. Men, mountains, and molehills. Maybe before I get into that, the saying written up on the board as mentioned by Titus already, it's kind of going around in my head. And in thinking about fathers, and in thinking actually about a man I want to speak of, you know, we may be formed, to a degree at least, by our past. But none of us here this morning have to be defined by our past. And to me, that's part of the great, big, wonderful God we serve. In that no matter what has happened, no matter what others have done, no matter the failure I've had, if I'm alive here this morning, I may be shaped and molded by that to a degree. I can't avoid that. But the exciting thing to me is that's not who I am. I am somebody redeemed, paid for by Christ, and I can live in victory and in power today because of Him. Praise His name. Okay, back to men, mountains, and molehills. I'm going to ask an obvious question. What is the difference between a mountain and a molehill? The size. Okay? There's something else, too. Anybody else? Somebody else want to say what the difference is? Okay. Good. So we have the substance. There's even something else yet I was still thinking about. Okay. Well, we're getting all kinds of them. Let's keep going. There's still another one. Okay. Well, we could keep going some more. The molehills, when I step on them, they seem pretty hollow. Have any of you stepped on a mountain that collapsed recently? Most of them are pretty solid, aren't they? So keep that in mind. Now, evidently, I'm not necessarily here to lecture you on mountains, the difference between mountains and molehills. I think most of you get at least a small aspect of that. So I want to talk about the mountains and the molehills of life in the life of men. Or maybe specifically in one man that I'll use as an example. Now I want to ask you, in the life, thinking now of life, what is most insurmountable? What's the hardest to get over, a molehill or a mountain? Oh, and especially the molehill of a mountain in the mind of a man. Have you ever thought of that? I think sometimes we have things that seem huge in our mind, right? And we look at them, and maybe we can even physically say, whoa, that's big. But do you think it makes any difference whose strength we're going on and who's what God we're serving as to whether it's a mountain or a molehill? And that pretty much occurs in my brain more than anywhere, doesn't it? So how many of you have faced a mountain, what you would have called a mountain in life? A mountain or a giant, I don't care. Most of you. Jason there almost didn't, but he got to it then. So, okay, good. How many of you have ever made a mountain out of a molehill? You know what I mean? You don't have to raise your hand because that's kind of embarrassing when you do that. I would have to. It's that kind of thing where you have this big thing and you know it's just huge and you just don't know how you're going to get through this. But finally, sooner or later, because of time or other people, you crash into this thing only to discover it kind of falls flat. Oh, it's nothing there. You ever done that? It makes you feel kind of cheap, but at the same thing, it doesn't really help you not to do it again. In fact, it kind of creates a trajectory for yourself. What causes us to do that? Why do we make some things bigger than they are? Does it have something to do with the size of God? And thinking about molehills and mountains, I have a friend, Dave. A very good friend, Dave, actually, that most of you probably will never get a chance to meet. And if you do meet him, I doubt you'll visit with him, so I can talk about him. And Dave is a fairly common name, so here we go. So Dave had me quite worried. I'm in pretty consistent contact with Dave. And all of a sudden, he just quit. I'd call him, let a voicemail, nothing. I'd text him, nothing. And kind of worried me, and I almost text or called somebody that knew, that lived a little closer to him than I do to see what was going on. I thought, well, you know, I really don't want to know if it's something very negative because I was kind of scared, actually, because of his background and stuff. So, you know, probably be better just to pray. I still kept wondering, what happened to Dave? I think it was Thursday or Friday. This week kind of melted together on me. I got a call, and here's Dave. And Dave says, I owe you an apology. I'm sorry. I said, well, it's just good to hear from you again. I said, that's fine. Well, he said, I really need to tell you more. He said, my wife and I had made a commitment not to eat any sugar. Their thought is, whether you agree or disagree, is that it makes you get the cold quicker. And so that's off the side, really. But he and his wife mutually agreed they weren't going to eat any sugar. I don't know if this specified period of time or not. But he said, I was down at the hardware store about 5 months ago, and I just impulsively bought a candy bar and ate the candy bar. And he said, when I did it, I knew I should tell my wife that I broke our agreement. See, it was no big deal up to that point. But he said, I felt so stupid. I felt really stupid. So he said, I didn't. And he said, since I'd already eaten one, it seemed okay to keep sneaking them, you know? And he said, finally, this thing just got bigger and bigger. And he said, I just felt stupider and stupider. He said, I betrayed trust. Anyway, so he said, finally, about a month ago, he said, I found enough courage to tell her what I was done. And because I can't go into all his past, but because of the life he's lived in the past, the trust they had managed to build in the last 2 years or so was very, very precious. And it took his wife on quite a ride to know that he was eating candy bars behind her back. And furthermore, Dave felt pretty bad. He had, in our conversations, he had kind of been projecting that he was doing fine in his Christian life, and here he was hiding candy bars in his life. So I don't know. You can look, is that a mountain or a molehill? And that's not necessarily my subject, but think about that. Okay, so my main message over here, I thought maybe some of my preaching the last couple times has been heavy for some of you, so I'm going to keep it hopefully shorter and mostly a story. So we have 12 men. I know at least two of these men were fathers, or it would seem fairly evident that they were. And 12 men that went on a big long trip. I was trying to think. I don't think I've ever gone on a trip as long as these fellows did. So these men, by the trip they took, I would be able to deduce they were all very physically fit. These men were not cowards. They were all very brave men. They were courageous achievers. These 12 men were all men that were looked up to and admired by their peers and by the other people around them. These 12 men were trusted and filled an important position with the people that they lived with. Something else that you probably take for granted, but I wanted to point it out, was that these 12 men all had two eyes, two ears, two arms, two legs, one nose, one voice, and one heart each. So they were fairly common men, yet in a way they had achieved. Now, in what they had, two eyes, two ears, two arms, two legs, one nose, one voice, and one heart, they did not use all these things the same, even though they all had them. 10 of these men had something hidden inside themselves. I'm going to say in their heart, but evidently it was more in their thought process. I'm going to call it a weakness in their heart. Now, I'm not talking about an aneurysm. I'm talking about an actual weakness in their heart as they thought of who they were, who God was, and how they related to life. You know, these 10 men out of these 12 saw things as they were. They really saw things as they were. As a man sees, so they saw. The other two men had a strength in their hearts. And again, this strength was not the strength of a cardiovascular system, but it was the strength of knowing who they were and who their God was and who that made them in the sight of God. These two men saw things as a man who serves and knows his Father, a great, big, wonderful God. And this made the hugest of difference between these 10 men and these two men. This made a huge difference in how these men used their arms, ears, legs, nose, and voice. So like I said, these 12 men went on a trip. And they walked a mighty long way. I didn't try to compute this. They didn't drive back then. And their job was to go search out another country that their country was planning to settle in. And then they were supposed to bring back a report to the rest of the nation and tell them what they saw, how they felt about the situation, what their options were. And so these men spent 40 days walking through this area and walking back to their homes at that point. So almost 6 weeks on the road. Now, it's a long trip, even walking. So if you want to check up on me in any of this, you can find it in Numbers 13, 14, and a bit in chapter 32. So these 12 men, they all returned. They had all seen and experienced the same things, more or less. They all saw, they all tasted, they all felt, they all heard the same things. They were all agreed in their report to an extent. They all began their report the same. They said, this new land, this place is amazing, it's wonderful. It's just abounding in all kinds of good stuff, flowing with milk and honey. And here we even have some of the fruit of it along with us, and they showed that off. But the next thing they said, at least that the 10 men said, and also that the one of the 2 men said, began to show the differences in their heart. Their view of God began to show up. Here's what the 10 men said. But the people of this land are strong, and the cities are walled, and very great, and we saw giants there. Whoa. So the fruit was great, the land was amazing. But we saw some strong cities. There's no way we can get into those towns. We saw some really big men. Well, one of the two men with a strength rather than a weakness in their heart, he waited till everybody was quiet and trying to digest this information. Then he says, let's go up at once and possess it, for we are well able to overcome. Now, was Caleb just proud? Was he weird? What was his problem with him? You know, the 10 men with the weakness in their hearts, the 10 men that saw with their eyes what man sees, said, no, that's not true. We cannot go up and fight these people. They are stronger than we are. This land, this place we have just been to, this land, yes, while the fruit is amazing, and actually this land eats up the people. I mean, we go up there, we are just going to disappear. Just bloop. That just eats up the inhabitants thereof, is what they said. And they said, all the people we saw were big men. And then, to top it off, we saw giants there, these sons of Anak. And they said, they were so big that when we walked down around them, we felt like grasshoppers. Now, that's a pretty radical difference. I don't know. You ever see anybody that big? I think one of the most impressively big men I ever saw was at a car dealership in Searcy. I'm thinking there was one more step than what we have here. Of course, now I'm probably on the short side of life. That's fine. But I think I would have been a good step higher. And his head was about even with mine when he stood down on the floor. So that was a pretty big guy. So I don't know. I still didn't. I felt small, but I did not feel like a grasshopper. So I can't totally associate with these people. But that's what they said. They said, you know, when we looked at these fellows, we're like grasshoppers. I don't know. You think they were exaggerating? Just maybe they were turning a molehill into a mountain. Anyway, then they go on and say that when they looked at us, I know I changed the wording just a little bit, but it means the same thing. That is what they thought. They said, ah, look at the little grasshoppers down there. Now, I don't know how they were supposed to know. If they were as small as grasshoppers in comparison to these giants, I doubt they would have had communication with them. So I'm not sure how they knew exactly how these men viewed them, but that's what they said. How would a grasshopper know what a giant thinks? But they did a good job of supposing. Now I want to ask you a question here. Did all 12 people see the same thing? I think they did. I'm pretty sure they did, in fact, if we'll come to it in Joshua then. So the ten did not see something different than what Caleb and Joshua saw. So what was different? Do you think the ten men, when they saw these great big tall fellows, however tall they were, I'm pretty sure they exaggerated rather tremendously, but no matter how big they were, they thought about themselves, didn't they? I'm pretty sure they thought about themselves. And they compared themselves to these big guys. And evidently they were smaller. Nobody argues that. So what did Joshua and Caleb do different? I don't know. Here's my thought, though. I wonder if Joshua and Caleb, when they saw these big, tall fellows, they're like, oh, they are bigger than me. But guess what? I serve a God who, not so long ago, brought water out of a rock in an absolutely dry place. What's a big guy in comparison to that? Right? I serve a God who has been feeding probably a couple million people out of manna every day. What's a big fellow compared to that? I serve a God who, when our leader holds up his rod, we can whoop any enemy that's ever come. What's a strong walled city and an armed man compared to that? Going back to the ten men, have you ever noticed that tendency in your own heart? Have you ever started fearing or worrying about something, someone? If you have done that, just rehearse it with yourself. What starts happening? Does your problem get bigger or smaller? You know, there are times, like I told you already, that I made something huge out of something, almost nothing. And then when I finally experienced it, I discovered that I had manufactured most of this. Other times, when I found faith and trust in God and just allowed Him to lead, I've looked back at some experiences and I'm like, how in the world did I ever make it through that? But you know what? It didn't seem so bad at the time. Well, going on back to the ten men, almost all the people in this huge company, this huge host, believed the ten men with a weakness in their hearts. The ten men who saw things as they were. The ten men who looked through the eyes of a man without God in their heart. And this is what they and the other people said. They said to their leaders, "Why did you bring us out here to die? Why did you bring our wives and children here to become hostages and slaves? It would have been so much better just to stay in bondage in Egypt. So much easier, so much more comfortable, and so much more secure." No, slavery secure. They said, "Let us make a captain, a real man that sees things as they are through the eyes of a man without God, and return to Egypt." Of course, they didn't say it. I said that. They did say, "Let's return to Egypt." Then the two men who saw things the way a man with a great big wonderful God sees things tore their clothes in frustration at the foolishness of the ten men and the other people and said, "This land is exceedingly good land, and God delights in us. I mean, please don't forget what's happened that's brought us here." It says, "He will bring us into this land. We can have confidence. The God that has done brought us through the Red Sea, that has fed us, that has given us water when we needed it. He's going to take care of us. He's going to give us this abundance of good things. Please don't rebel against God. Don't fear these people. They are food for us." In other words, they are our prey. They're sitting ducks. With God on our side, nothing can stop us. When God is helping us to go, I think it's in Psalms, it says we can jump over that wall. Their defense is departed. God is with us. Fear them not. Wow. You know how the people responded? The people said, and again in my words, "Don't listen to such crazies. They can't see what's right in front of their eyes. Those giants are huge. Those walls are thick and strong. In fact, maybe we'd better get rid of these crazy guys. Let's stone them, is what they said. We don't need people like this around. You know, God stepped in at this point, and he was going to turn the tables and actually kill all these people. All these men who looked at things through the eyes of men. All these men who saw things as they were without God in their heart. Yet because of their leaders pleading for them, God said, I won't kill them now. But none of them that doubted my ability to help them win over the giants will be allowed to experience the blessings of the land. Every last one of those 20 years old and older is going to die before you can go. Then God also said, I'll just read that, but my servant Caleb, because he hath another spirit with him and hath followed me fully, him will I bring into the land. He and his children will own a part of it. Caleb and Joshua, out of all the 603,550 men who left Egypt, there was only two that got to go to the place that God had promised. Out of 603,550 men, two. So that means that there was 603,448 men that had to die before God could work. You know, when we go in our own strength, when we serve self, fear will make huge mountains out of molehills and will make bigger giants than whatever existed because we're looking at ourselves. When we go in God's strength, even huge mountains become surmountable and even giants begin to shrink. All the 10 men with the 10 weak hearts who saw things as they were to a man without God in his heart died from a plague that God sent to kill him. The two men with hearts that saw things the way that a man with a big, great, big, wonderful God sees them were still alive. In fact, very much so. If you want to, that's found in Joshua chapter 14, verse 6. This is now 45 years later. It's quite a bit higher than the mean or median age here. 45 years later, a long time. A lot longer. I was going to say a lot longer than what I've lived, and it is. But here they were, these two men. They were still wholly following God. They were still there, still doing. They were still seeing things as a man with a great, big, wonderful God. I don't know if you thought about this when you read the Old Testament story, but talk about a generation gap. So you had a whole nation with only two people over 65. Anyways, I just side note. We don't know exactly how old Joshua was, or at least I didn't find it. But Caleb was a good 20 years older than anybody else there. Excuse me. Yeah, 20. He was 40, so that's right. So in Joshua, chapter 6 there, you know, after the main wars of the conquest are over in the land of Canaan, Israel's kind of gathered at Gilgal, dividing out the inheritance. We have Caleb come to Joshua. And he says this. He says, you know the thing that the Lord said to Moses concerning me and you in Kadesh Barnea? He says, I was 40 years old when Moses sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land. And I brought him word again as it was in mine heart. He's saying, 45 years later, I still told the truth. I still relayed what I saw with God's help. He goes on and says, you know the others, our brethren that went up with us, made the heart of the people to melt in fear. But he says this, but I wholly followed the Lord, my personal God. Moses promised me on that day, saying, surely the land where your feet have walked will be your inheritance, because you have wholly followed the Lord. He says, behold, I said, think about it. God kept me alive, as he said, these 45 years, ever since the Lord spoke this word to Moses. And now I am this day 85 years old. And he goes on and says, I am as strong this day as I was in that day, or in my 40s. As my strength was then, even so is my strength now, for war and to fight and to work.
Now he says this to Joshua, "Now therefore give me this mountain."
You got to remember, if you do a little research, the area he referred to next was the very strongest area with the very biggest people. 45 years later, Caleb's faith hadn't waned one little bit. He said, "Give me the worst area, so to speak. Give me the area where these big people are. Give me the area with the thickest walled cities. Now therefore, give me this mountain stronghold, the one God promised to me in that day. I am not yet done. For you heard how the Anakims were there, the biggest of the giants, and how the cities were great and walled. God will be with me, and I will be able to drive them out, as he said." Joshua replied, Joshua blessed him and gave unto Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, Hebron for an inheritance. Hebron therefore became the inheritance of Caleb, because he wholly followed the Lord God of Israel. There's a couple of verses in Psalms that very much sound like Caleb. Psalm 84, verse 5 through 7, and verse 11 and 12. "Blessed is the man whose strength is in thee, the Lord, in whose heart are the ways of them, God's ways, who passing through the valley of Baca, the dry desert valley, make it a well. The rain also fills the pools through faith. They go from strength to strength. Every one of them in Zion appeareth before God. For the Lord God is a sun and a shield. The Lord will give grace and glory. No good thing will he withhold from them who walk uprightly. O Lord of hosts, blessed is the man that trusteth in thee." Proverbs 14, verse 26 and 27. In the fear, in a reverential awe of God, is a strong confidence. This man, his children shall have a place of refuge. The fear of a reverential awe of God is a fountain of life, to depart from the snares of death. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 24 through 27. "Now ye know..." Excuse me, I must have garbled something here. "Now ye know not that... not all those that run in a race run all, but one receiveth the prize." So Paul is saying, we know that in a race, when you run a race, there's a lot of runners. But he says, we know they don't all win. Only one wins. In Matthew chapter 25, it talks about those people that on judgment day, they say, "Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in thy name, and in thy name have cast out devils, and in thy name done many wonderful works?" He said, "Depart from me. I never knew you." That's the kind of people last time. There are many people today, unfortunately, who are saying, "I'm a Christian," and they can give a wonderful testimony. But they're not going to ruin the prize at the end of the race. So Paul goes on and says, "So run that you may obtain." He says, "Every man that striveth for the mastery or strives to win is temperate in all things." And he's saying, then he goes on and says, "Now they do it for an earthly crown, a corruptible crown. But we an incorruptible," those athletes, those people that are temperate in all things, they do it so they can hit the ball further. They do it so they get more fame and glory from men. But he's saying, we're doing something far better. We're doing it for something that lasts for eternity. Then Paul goes on and gives his personal testimony. He says, "I therefore so run, not as uncertainly. I know where I'm going and I know what I'm doing. I've quit looking back over my shoulder at the things that happened to me back there. I've released, forgiven, and moved on. So fight I, not as one beating the air." Then he goes on, he says, "But I keep under my body and bring it into subjection, lest by any means, when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway." In life, what is the difference between a mountain and a molehill? Potentially, What makes a mountain or makes a molehill out of whatever we face is whether we choose to see God or we look at ourselves. And dear friends, if we're going to look at ourselves, Paul tells us clearly, and that is in me, and dwelleth my flesh, no good thing. You see, without God, a molehill becomes a mountain. With God and His strength, and a heart that wholly follows after God, a mountain becomes a potential molehill. It is not the size of the hill or the mountain that counts, but the size of the God we serve. And so I want to end with a verse that I read 2 weeks ago. To wholly follow God is to deny myself, what I want, what I like, what I would pursue. Take up my cross. To each and every day crucify, restrict, and curb the flesh and its lustful desires. And follow Christ. To do and be what Christ would do and be. That, my friends, is the way of Christ. That, fellow fathers, is the real strength of a man. Let's kneel for prayer.